On today's College Football Inquirer, I'm not Andy Staples, but I am here to talk about college football playoff expansion not moving for now, but potentially a battle between ESPN and Fox could change the landscape. Also, Tommy Tuberville, of all people, is warning about government influence in college sports. And also, the University of Florida is spending a lot of money to renovate a stadium, but not make it any bigger. Why is that so important? All this and more on today's College Football Inquirer. Welcome to the College Football Inquirer. I'm not Andy Staples. I am on this show. My name is Stephen Godfrey. I don't normally host. I'm as scared and alarmed as you are. Andy Staples, our fearless leader, is on vacation. I would say sabbatical and be funny about it, but then people would think, when is he coming? He'll be back next week. Everything is fine. Ross Dellinger, if you couldn't notice by his byline and his social media account, is very, very much on assignment in the bowels, the large, girthy bowels of Washington, D.C., for the Senate markup. I know we're all excited about that. He'll be back on Tuesday to talk about that. He was also in Denver. So what do I do? Do I do a show by myself? The executives at Yahoo said, please don't. And so I said, all right, I know a guy who went to law school and he might know a little bit about college football. Please welcome my Phantom Island co-host, Ryan Nanny. How are you, sir?
I feel like I've been moved up from AA. Like somebody called me and said, hey, pack your stuff. Get on the bus. It's time. You're gonna go pitch in the majors. And the goal is just to hang around,
okay, frankly. I feel like we're squatting. Like, like the authorities are going to show up at any second.
I appreciate
second.
That I'm like, hey, aspirational, mm-hmm, like success. Yeah. And you're embracing the fear basement.
Oh, without a
good.
Doubt. As
this
usual.
Is good.
Yeah. My anxiety is informing this that we are squatting right now in the lovely confines of the College Football Inquirer, which I have snuck in, to use the correct English. And now I have brought my buddy in and someone's going to be like, you guys didn't even sign a lease. You didn't pay any rent. No. Get out of here. Ryan is my co-host on Phantom Island. We cover college football. We cover a variety of sports. You can go to phantomisland.show to learn more about that wonderful program. And we will reference a couple episodes we've recorded because I don't know if you guys have noticed, there's been a little bit illegal in the world of college football this summer. If you're out there and you want to go to journalism school and you want to cover college football and you think, I should know a lot about scheme. No, I should know a lot about like how businesses. No, you should just go to law school. Like my friend Ryan Nanny, which of course from the beginning, that was the point when you attended law school many years ago. You thought one day this will be quintessential for working college football podcast segments. Is that correct?
Yeah. And my parents were totally on board with that. And they've been super happy with my choices ever since.
Yeah.
NYU doesn't reach out to me that much anymore, but I'm sure they're proud of me too.
Yeah, we'll go with that. They don't. It's because they need a better football presence. All right. What I did for the first segment is just simply pick one of the varietal Ross Dellinger tweets from the various news that he's been covering both in Denver at the college, let's call it the College Sports Commissioner Conference. I don't need to look that up, but that's basically what he was doing. That's what he told me. He's now back in DC for Senate markup on the Save College Sports Act. I pulled yesterday one piece of news that we're going to talk about today, because as it relates to the Senate markup, we're going to get a little bit into government oversight and government involvement in sports in general in a later segment. But right now I want to talk about something else that's just, it's the normal eye rolling controversy in our sport, which is the size of our playoff. Real quick, Ryan Nanny, how many teams are in the college football playoff?
Well, right now I still, based on when we're recording, I think we're still at 12.
No, the correct answer is no one knows. Okay.
Okay. Gotcha.
All right. So here's a report from Ross after the college commissioners meeting out in Colorado. He says CFP leaders ended their meeting here in Denver with no decision on expansion, according to Rich Clark. While consultants delivered presentations on 16 and 24 team formats, no media evaluation figures were shared. Media evaluation is what we're going to talk about in a second here. Discussion centered on scheduling of a 24 team field and how to do it. All right. And then he has a follow-up. CFP staff is working on answering questions related to operation of a potential 24-team expansion bracket and the scheduling of it, which poses issues in a tight December calendar. Ryan, I want to talk about that tight December calendar for a second. Now, as it stands in the 12-team playoff, many, many people inside of college sports that aren't, let's say, direct stakeholders, meaning that they don't actually line their pockets with revenue from the playoff, a lot of people don't love the way the playoff is scheduled currently. Right, we've had 2 years of a 12-team format. Many people have complained it feels sort of anticlimactic when the penultimate games are played kind of randomly on weeknights as you get into that kind of like post-holiday funk. There's a bigger problem at hand in a story that you noticed as well. We are now going to do something incredibly shameless. And look, no one's here. We're the substitute teachers, okay? You know what that is? That's a video cart. It's a TV cart being pulled in here, guys. We're going
to
watch a video.
It's time to watch Glory.
Hey.
Get excited.
Is this science class? Does Jurassic Park count? It sure did in my public school 100%. Education. Ryan, yeah. You noticed something yesterday about really the two key stakeholders in anything to do with college football, which is Fox and Disney. Notice we didn't say the Big Ten and the Southeastern Conference. We talked about Fox and Disney, specifically ESPN. If you guys aren't aware, there's a small sporting event going on in the United States that represents the entire globe. It's called the World Cup. If you're alarmed right now, if you're already alarmed that we're hosting, I'm sorry. If you're alarmed that we're going to talk soccer, please bear with me. It won't hurt. It won't turn you into a socialist. But Fox holds all the rights to the World Cup. They hold them all. They got them all. Okay. ESPN used to carry the World Cup in the United States. Fox got them all. There's a little bit of kerfluffle, Ryan. You can explain this. Allegedly, amongst Fox executives about how ESPN is covering what is, bar none and without argument, the biggest sporting event in the world.
Yes. So Front Office Sports a couple days ago ran a story that I'll read a little bit from directly, where, quote, some Fox executives are frustrated at what they perceive as ESPN's lack of coverage around the first men's World Cup held in the U.S. since 1994. They were especially ticked off by ESPN's apathetic approach to this past weekend when the U.S. men's national team convincingly defeated Paraguay 4-1. Here's the quote from one source. Quote, we're talking about a historic performance by Team USA. Where in the hell was ESPN? There's not like a lot of minute detail in this story, I wouldn't say. Mm-mm. But there is this sort of general sense that some people at Fox who, I don't know, how high up on the food chain, I don't know that either, are annoyed that ESPN is not giving the World Cup the love and the shine that it deserves. ESPN and Fox have both responded to this story. Both sort of say, we think that this is nonsense. A Fox Sports spokesperson sent Front Office Sports the following statement. This is simply not true. We are focused on our own coverage of the biggest event in the world, not on what others choose to air. And frankly, it's insulting to ESPN to suggest that they would pass on covering it. This is all absurd. ESPN, for its part, has said, listen, we're covering this just as we cover other major sporting events. Like, look, I will say in ESPN's limited defense,
yeah,
they have Stephen A. Smith talking about the World Cup. I don't know if you want Stephen A. Smith talking about the World Cup, but it is happening. There's a lot we can get into about like the way in which clips of the World Cup are tightly restricted. It's much, much more like the Olympics than it is NFL, NBA, insert other big four American sport here. So there are some limitations. Scott Van Pelt has very amusingly had Taylor Twellman draw.
Hand-drawn highlights, Ryan, because there's an embargo on using the footage until X amount of hours, not after the game, my friend, but after Fox's post-match coverage of each individual World Cup match, then up to 2 minutes are allowed to be licensed out to only
certain programs.
In
circumstances. Yeah, exactly.
It's absolutely insane. So longtime listeners and viewers of this program, longtime being since last August when I joined this program, are aware that I don't miss a chance to criticize the four-letter network and their handling of college football and their corrupt ownership of the sport. I'm going to be honest with you. This is not one of those times, and I know you're asking, well, why are we talking about the World Cup? What's going on here? ESPN's doing what they can. These are incredibly hard circumstances in order to have a television network and cover a television event when you don't really get the television footage. I do think it's silly. What's interesting to me about this, in the dead of summer, as we start to approach another college football season in which we are still very unsettled about the future of our sports postseason, is that these are the two stakeholders. There's an interesting piece at Awful Announcing where the Awful Announcing editorial team really kind of ran down this leak from Fox to the point where I think Ben Koo, one of their editors, actually went out on social and said, hey, this was dangled to us and we passed. FOS ran it. And I can't confirm or deny any of that, but who doesn't love to watch a mess? What's interesting to me about this is these two entities, not only do they have to agree upon a temporary and long-term solution for the future of the college football playoff, but it's very, very clear here, Ryan, that one entity in Fox wants to blow this thing out, right? They want to make it as big as possible. They want to go to 24. They're doing that via support or sort of via introduction from people in the Big Ten. One other entity, which currently really has its arms all the way around the college football playoffs postseason inventory, is ESPN. And the Southeastern Conference, their business partner, coincidentally says, hey, 12, maybe 16 tops after that, right. you are a heretic. Now, what does that mean? It's very interesting because we're having a hard enough time, and this is a real problem, placing inventory, right? What Ross reported in Denver, it's very legit, the concern I can understand. Take away the bias for a second. If you're a pro Big Ten or pro SEC person, or if you're one of the members of the college football media that 24 teams in a playoff is somehow going to break a sport that breaks itself every 6 months, where are we going to put all these games?
Well, Fox would tell you we're going to put them on Fox. So I went back and I went all the way back through the advent of the BCS in the mid to late 90s. And I said, I went and I looked and I said, okay, I'm going to gather all the broadcast data for every time either the BCS championship or a playoff game, whether it was the 4-team or the 12-team playoff. And I just want to see like what network these aired on.
Mm-hmm.
You may remember there's a brief little window of time where Fox had the BCS championship game, the 06 and 08 seasons, go Gators, and the 07 season. They have the BCS for that. They had the BCS broadcast for the 09 season, but I believe that game was played in the Rose Bowl, which the Rose Bowl never licensed, like never gave up the license to Fox,
right,
even during this period. So other than those three national championship games, everything else since 1998, every time you have seen a team theoretically playing for a national championship or on the road to a national championship in the postseason has been on ABC or ESPN, with the exception of those first round games that they've sublicensed to Turner, who incidentally is not Fox. And thinking about this in the World Cup context, it's like, I think there is a case to be made that right now, these networks really want championship inventory. Like, inventory is good. Having NFL games is good. Having NFL playoff games is great.
It's the
having
best.
Having the Super Bowl is great.
Yes. And television ratings would tell us it is the most valuable piece of intellectual property that you can put on American, North American, Western culture television, period.
Right. I think it's why Fox has held rights to the World Series. I feel like we're coming up on 30 years. It's been a while. Fox has had the World Series for a long time. ABC, ESPN have had the NBA Finals for a long time. These are not properties that Chart has not gone up on these, spoiler, but they're still championship properties, and so they have some value that I think they want to hold on to. Mostly this reminded me that when we talk about Fox and ESPN in the context of the college football playoff or the Super League or whatever, I kind of fall into this trap where I think, oh, Fox Big Ten, ESPN, SEC. But these are competing businesses across a variety of sports and industries and ways in which they're sort of going at each other. And I think the reason why this World Cup dust up, which may be real, maybe not, which may be meaningful, maybe not, is that it's a good reminder of like, oh, we don't just have to get Fox and ESPN to come to an agreement on this. Like, it works within the context of everything else they're doing. Who is rumored to be behind the whole DOJ antitrust congressional heat being turned up on the NFL?
Ryan,
do you remember who it is?
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because the Sports Broadcasting Act itself is under a referendum right now. Ryan, isn't it a coincidence, sir, that certain Fox News personalities are speaking out publicly? They're going to D.C. to speak in front of congressional hearings about how unfair the National Football League is being to consumers. Now, as someone wearing a t-shirt from the National Football League as we broadcast this, I do believe that the National Football League, and specifically one franchise, have actually caught, you're a lawyer, maybe we have something in the class action
flavor
right now.
You want to do an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim?
Against the Atlanta Falcons? Absolutely.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Am I happy that I shell out hundreds of dollars to be punched in the face metaphorically for 3 hours every Sunday? No. But let's read between the lines here for a second. Fox is still in the linear TV business. This is a big deal. ESPN, as many, many, many headlines have covered for the last 4 or 5 years, is trying to maintain its market share as well as its girthy revenue by moving into the streaming space. Disney Plus, Hulu Live, the various iterations. Do you remember ESPN3? They've been doing this for about 10 to 15 years now, right?
You know what's a really good example of this is baseball. Like ESPN made a big show of we're getting out of our baseball contract. Then they got back in, but it's like what they really bought was MLB TV. Like they have some broadcast deal. There is some, but like they didn't pay for wild card. They didn't pay for playoff games. They didn't pay for All-Star. They said MLB TV is the thing we want. And it's why you had, at the start of the season, a flood of people being like, wait, I have to subscribe to what to get to MLB TV now? This sucks. I hate this.
Ryan, I have a question for you as we try and sort of understand the context of what's going on. I'm a big proponent on this show of follow the money. I don't really follow the legalese as much because certainly we've seen suits and countersuits, and certainly a plaintiff's attorney is going to do whatever a plaintiff's attorney can for billable hours. You follow the money, sir. And the money this week showed a very interesting wrinkle in this conversation, right? So if Fox is a linear television-based property and they are pushing for an expanded playoff via the Big Ten, you would think it's to grab some of that sweet, sweet inventory, right? 24-team playoff means more games, means we're gonna pepper this along the Fox networks. Now, if you're listening or watching this and you're thinking, hey, man, I watched a college football playoff game on TNT last year. I want to remind everybody that that's a sub-licensing agreement from ESPN. Okay, so basically they buy the whole inventory for the college football playoff. And then in particular instances, and since some of us only listen on audio, they can't see me doing these beautiful finger quotes with my long, gnarled fingers. It's basically wherever ESPN holds rights to an NFL broadcast, and then you would have a college football playoff game running opposite, that's not smart business for ESPN. So they sub-license those games. They've done that to TNT, and I believe, I double-checked the last time we talked about this, you could also stream those particular college football playoff games on the streaming device, which I believe was HBO Max or Max or whatever it was called at the time, right? So they are siphoning this out. There's precedent for this. But I want to go back to a news item that happened this week. So Fox is, we don't stream. We're linear, okay? Your father-in-law's cable box. That's how you get Fox properties, which most of us understand. That's usually when we're exposed to Fox properties that aren't sports. Fox Corporations, I'm reading from Cord Cutter News this week. $22 billion acquisition of, Ryan, what's the TV in our Phantom Island office right now? It is a?
It's a Roku.
It's a Roku TV.
Roku City is under new management.
That amazing screensaver that we all have, certainly as parents, we all have. You ever just put your kid in front of the Roku screensaver? That's fine, by the way. We're not here to judge.
I think it's a good throwback to like when we had screensavers on
like Windows 98
desktop computer. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We had flying toasters. They have Roku City. It's fine.
Well, Roku City's under new management, and it's the Murdoch family. Dun, dun, dun. So why, Ryan, why is Fox buying physical televisions and streaming boxes? Well, they're not, okay? Because what Roku has done in recent years, wisely, is they say, all right, well, we have the platform. We have the delivery device now. You basically, as Americans, have started buying televisions with the cable box, again, in finger quotes, built into the machine. So if we hold the platform and we license agreements with Apple Plus, with YouTube TV, with all the other different ways that you absorb your, you know, Disney Plus, all the ways that you would absorb sports or entertainment, well, we should start streaming on our own, right? What Fox is doing is they're essentially trying to leapfrog and take out a better chunk of where people are streaming content. Now, does this automatically lead me to a thesis or a direction on how this portends for the college football playoff? Not yet, but Fox moving into a stronger position in the streaming space would, I think, rationally, based off of the people in the television industry that I talk to, tell me that they're looking to increase inventory. All this to be said, I don't think that we're going to leave our positions anytime soon on Fox and the Big Ten wanting to expand the playoff and the SEC and Disney wanting to expand less.
The thing that it makes me wonder, the Super Bowl rotates between the big three networks that have contracts with the NFL. Like that's just how the NFL has arranged it. And everybody seems to be fine with it. Like depending on the teams you get, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, whatever. Can't control that. A lot of the framing of Fox wants to go to 24 so that there's more inventory, I think has the assumption built in of, oh, well, Fox will get first or maybe second round games. ESPN's never going to, like, ESPN's not going to give up the semifinals, the national championship. But that doesn't mean, like, part of me is like, Fox is going to want to pry its way in the same way, way back in the day, Fox pried its way into getting NFL coverage at all. The same way Fox owns the World Series now. I find
and the
it
World
really
Cup,
hard.
Ryan?
Yes, and the World Cup. Like, that's the other part of this. Fox maybe is pissed about the way ESPN is handling this. Former ESPN president John Skipper has gone out and said, like, ESPN, at least he, and I think by extension ESPN at the time, were pretty pissed about the more or less no-bid deal that Fox got from FIFA for World Cup rights when they left ESPN in the first place. So there's bad blood there. There's frustration there, whatever. But I kind of made, I'm just speculating here. I feel like if Fox succeeds and we expand the playoff, part of the goal for that has to be for them to say, well, hang on. Now we're a playoff inventory stakeholder. We don't think ESPN should get every national championship game. We don't think ESPN should get every semifinal game. We think we should move closer to an NFL model where, you know, we understand we'll have to pay for it and we'll have to step up. Because the other thing lurking in all the back of this, to go back to the NFL as well, is that when the NFL's rights are coming up, in 2029, I believe, that we're all sort of like looking at as like, okay, this is when this is going to happen.
It's like the big bang of television rights, right? Because everything will follow the NFL.
Right. There are some open questions from people smarter than me who follow sports business closer than I do. But there are some questions about, like, is the NFL going to take this away from Fox? In part because rumoredly, and it's a very open rumor at this point, Rupert Murdoch was the one who sort of spurred the White House to start this antitrust investigation. And is there like, is Fox making moves in reaction to potentially being like, oh, we're about to get cut out from the most valuable domestic piece of television, and so we need to buttress in these other areas. We need a 2014 playoff, and we need to be a big part of it, because what do we do if we don't have NFL games anymore? I don't know.
Ryan, I'm so glad you brought up the National Football League, which is a like them, love them, or hate them. An extremely well-organized and sharpened point at the top of a powerful spear, which is the exact opposite of how college football is run. And when we come back, we'll talk about the continued morass that is shirking responsibility and passing the buck to the United States government for oversight of a sport, and why that might be a really bad idea. This is the College Football Enquirer. My name is Stephen Godfrey. It is Substitute Teacher Edition Day here in, we'll call it late June, mid-June. Nobody has to pay a ton of attention. This is summer school. Accordingly, that is Ryan Naney, my co-host from Phantom Island over at phantomisland.show. Hey, Ryan, let's just continue to cheat off Ross's paper. You feel good about that? Or do you want to do any reporting right now?
No,
we'll just put the show on pause while I make a couple calls.
Just read Ross's Twitter account. It's fine.
Okay, cool. It's worked for me so far on this show. So, all right, what we're going to talk about now is the fact why Ross is not here. Ross is somewhere in D.C., okay? I want there to be 7 inches of blue cigar smoke wherever he is. It's probably not. I think my image is probably ruined here. We are in the sort of markup phase for the Protect College Sports Act, all right? Now, I know everybody is just so eager to talk about this again, but what we are going to do is explore a really kind of look. The segment we're about to do is going to involve horse racing, all right? Because our friend Matt Stahl over at AL.com wrote another piece that was really interesting. Ryan, you are, all joking aside, I guess I have to describe you as a former lawyer. Is that correct? You have lawyered before.
That's the safest way to describe it.
Okay. All right. So, we're in the markup phase, and one of the things that I want to point out is that if you're following along with Ross, or as this happens, before we finish the markup phase, what you're seeing is, I would say, everybody sort of going back to their original character who's involved in this bill. So this includes special interests. This includes people who are kind of in this for one specific thing. You see the NCAA coming out early this morning, basically. Ross reported that their suggestions have essentially been to try to prevent any legislation from a single athlete that would challenge any of the conventions. And I'm using a very generic terminology here because all this stuff is in progress. So, for example, not only is the NCAA telling lawmakers right now as they go through markup phase to prevent a Trinidad Chambliss case from happening again, they're trying to actually retroactively block Trinidad Chambliss from playing football this September, to give you an idea of where we're at. Now, in other areas and other special interests, it's as wild as there's the anti-trans debate going on, right? There are revenue concerns, and you can kind of see from the affiliation, not so much Republican or Democrat, but where these individuals are in their respective states. Maybe the interests they represent in terms of on the field or in a particular conference. I have some brutal news, Ryan, and I'm going to go ahead and hand this off to you because you confirmed this. The brutal news is this. Former Auburn coach, Tommy Tuberville, he has a good point.
He has raised a point that has got him on the same side as Darren Heitner, sports lawyer who, I don't know, I feel like if you're on Twitter, you've probably been mad at Darren Heitner over the last 6 months.
Can you explain to the uninitiated the position that Darren Heitner normally occupies?
I think Darren Heitner, not to speak too much for him, would more or less say that every NCAA regulation and limitation is per se unlawful because it hasn't been negotiated with players. Maybe I'm going out too far for him, but if there is a NCAA restriction, I think Darren Heitner is happy to take them to court over it.
Okay.
And people have a lot of big feelings about that in mostly one direction, but sometimes in both directions.
Okay. Tommy Tuberville's push here is that, hey guys, and again, extremely weird because Tommy Tuberville, since he's entered his political career, has not been one to sort of tap the brakes or shy away from hyperbole, regardless of your political affiliation. But Tommy Tuberville is waving a flag. Ryan, can you explain what this flag is? This flag is basically saying, hey, we're going to sort of create an endless cycle here if we start this way right now, meaning talking about government oversight of college sports.
Yeah. I mean, to put it sort of distilled down to its simplest terms, I think what the senator from Alabama is presenting is that the way Ted Cruz and Maria Cantwell's bill is currently set up, it enmeshes the federal government in the operation of college sports in a very deep way that you can't really pull out of. He has his own bill that he's proposed, which is much shorter and much more just about like, let's create some basic rules for eligibility, transfers, but let's just like pick off a few things and say, this is how this will work according to federal law. And now we pass it down to the NCAA. What the Save College Sports Act would do is much more protect college sports. It's so hard to.
The syntax is terrible. It's a terribly named act. They don't have a marketing team. That's obvious.
That's true.
It's very clumsy. So feel free to step over it.
But the problem that it presents is that, well, I guess you can look at it in one of two ways. I think we have sort of collectively assumed like Congress will come in. They will save the NCAA and fix college sports forever. And then we'll go back to the way it was. The NCAA will run things. We'll get cranky about them, but things will be fine. You know, Olympic sports will be saved and athletes will get money, but not too much money, and they won't be too troublesome about it. The problem with that is that we'll still have this big federal law in the book. And one of the interesting things about living in the United States and the system of government that we have is that laws can change. Laws can be challenged in court. Laws can be amended. Laws can be picked apart over years. Like, I think...
like a Voting Rights Act.
Sure, sure.
Same-sex like, marriage.
Whatever you want to pick, like, there is no... I think it's naive to suggest that Congress will do this and then Congress will step away and never get involved whatsoever in any way. And so for the people who are sort of like, obviously with the Sorsby thing, there's been a lot of lamenting about why are judges involved in this? Why is the judicial system involved in this? It's slow. It doesn't understand the subject material. It's incredibly biased. I have a hard time saying that Congress is better at any of those things. I can't look at Congress and be like, well, there's a fast-moving, even-keeled operation that has a deep understanding of the nuances and the particular problems of everything that they touch. Like, I think you're just trading problems here.
Yes.
And the difference is, instead of paying a filing fee to get into state court somewhere, congratulations, we're making money for a bunch of lobbyists all the time.
Well, and look, in its simplest terms, which is what I always seek to arrive at for the largest audience possible here, this is not going to be, if you are in favor of the Save College Act, if you are in favor of most of the rhetoric that Cruz and Cantwell have assembled, at least in sort of the middle of the thing, as we go through markup, like, again, you're seeing very specific sort of partisan barnacles come on because our form of government is really infallible. Who are we kidding? We're such a well-run country. But if you believe in sort of the central idea of this thing, what's scary about what Tuberville has proposed or sort of posited, just kind of quietly mentioned, and by the way, people in the legal community are like, yeah, dog, that's why we're all millionaires, is we just keep coming to work, is that this is the opposite of a fix in the sense of set it and forget it, right? Or, hey, we went through this issue in a seminal moment in American history, and then there was I think a lot of people who have no legal understanding, myself included, right? Bombed out of common law more than once in mass media law, they call it at Ole Miss. I think we think of Brown versus the Board of Education, right? Yeah. A moment that changed something that we fundamentally perceive in the United States. This is much more like, oh, we're going to have this problem a year from now. This is going to be revisited and amended and tweaked and bothered with and countersued 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 years from now. And that is the most foreboding thing possible for a sport that is already laden with this problem. In our first segment, Ryan, we just talked about the college football playoff has essentially never been the same since it was introduced as a 12-team format. Probably the calmest we've actually had in the entire history of the college football postseason, going all the way back to the 20s, were those handful of years with the four teams in the four-team format. Because you and I we were both working in college sports media when the four-team format was introduced. If you're, you know, a certain age in terms of youth, you remember the BCS a little bit. The problem with the BCS wasn't the BCS format. It was the BCS format changed every year.
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine that amount of unnecessary revision, agenda-oriented fighting, all this kind of stuff happening for the core construct of all of college sports year after year after year after year.
Yeah, I think like the easiest way to sort of wrap your mind around it is, okay, something passes. Maybe it's this Cruz-Cantwell bill. Maybe it's a modified version of it. 5 years after that, oh, this bill has failed to anticipate a problem that pops up.
Yeah.
This bill has something that we don't like. Like, we don't like the Lane Kiffin rule. It turns out that schools have thought about it, and maybe they don't like Lane Kiffin, but they don't like the Lane Kiffin rule.
Or in a much more likelier reality, Ryan, no mm-hmm. one is following the Lane Kiffin rule.
Sure, sure. And so you get into this point where you're like, okay, well, if this law is on the books, the way the NCAA was constituted, or is constituted, I should say, if they have a bylaw they don't like, the membership can get together, as they do every year, and say, we want to make a change. This can be as simple as, you know, sort of saying, okay, we think that now you should be allowed, a team should be allowed to pay for family members to go to bowl games. Like, yeah. It can be very small stuff, whatever. But it can all operate internally, and it can move relatively quickly. Now you're talking about, if we want to change this law, if we want to add a piece to it, if we want to take away a piece, if we want to change it, we have to go through the legislative process. We have to get 60 senators, you know, we have to do the whole thing to make this happen every time we want to make this
change. Seems efficient.
And that's before, should we talk about the horse racing bit now?
Yeah, so I want to bridge this over a little bit because there's sort of a canary in the coal mine. I know everyone here who's a huge college football fan is constantly breathlessly awaiting news from the horse racing industry as if it's 100 years ago and we're all chomping on those cigars that Ross is breathing in currently. Matt Stahl, who is a Kentucky native, and I think you write what you know, and Matt has done this excellently.
I thought he's a Tennessee native.
He went to Western Kentucky.
And in college sports media, you are from Tennessee.
In college sports media, you are only your degree.
I just don't want to misrepresent him.
Ross and I have been trying to murder each other for years because we're on opposite sides of the Egg Bowl. This is not something we even want to do. It's just in college sports. It's in the college sports covenants. All right. Okay. I legally have to have you on the show today. We're going to talk about the Gators in a second because a witch gave me a curse, and I cannot work in college sports media unless it's with one Florida graduate at all times.
Sure.
Spencer Hall, Andy Staples, Richard Johnson, yeah. yourself. It's just
today
a rule.
I am today for the audience. I am. We have Andy Staples at home. That's what's happening.
Oh, I had. Let's go with Aldi brand, Andy Staples.
Yeah,
I apologize. Sure, I'm sorry. All right. So Matt Stahl, he, I love the lead that he wrote in the headline, which was, hey, while none of y'all could stop talking about that situation at Texas Tech, there's actually a thing here. Now, Ryan, this was the conceit. This was the core of bringing you on the show, because this is a little thorny. Okay. Yeah. But Matt ran this story in AL.com, and it does have an application to what's going on in college football right now. Can you explain the TLDR here is that Congress intervened in a big way into horse racing. Yes.
Yes. Congress set up sort of a governing, an external governing body.
And we all lived happily ever after.
Regulate horse. No, that's not what happened.
Okay. Tell me what happened.
There is a legal principle called the non-delegation doctrine. And I can feel you listening to this or watching this and being so bored.
Instant coma.
But this is important, because what it basically says is that Congress is Congress. It writes the laws, and it can't just give that power away.
Yeah.
This is a legal principle that really had a lot more force a long time ago, like in the 20s, and has not had a lot of major application in recent years, but it still exists and it still gets brought up. And in the case of this horse racing commission, Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals determined that on two different occasions. First, that that it had too much rulemaking authority. Congress went back and made some changes and sort of fixed that so that I forget which. I think it's maybe the FTC. I don't remember which supervisory entity in the government that sits over it would have a bigger role. And that it has, more recently, too much enforcement authority. And what this is all built to sort of do is to say, okay, if we live in a democracy, it should be democratic pieces that actually create and enforce legislation. You shouldn't have Congress just saying, I don't know, let this industry figure it out. We give them our blessing. They can do the job. We don't want to deal with it. Courts have said that's not how this works, mostly because we want somebody who can be accountable. Maybe that is back to Congress through, you know, elected membership. Maybe that's through an executive branch group that is accountable in different ways, but still answers to somebody. We want to create a system where if you are enforcing federal law in some way,
okay,
that you are accountable up the ladder some way. All right. So how does this apply to the NCAA? Well,
I have no idea, but keep going.
This principle, as Matt's article and his and a law paper that I read only part of, it's pretty long, that Sam Ehrlich was a co-writer on.
Sam Ehrlich, look, college football Twitter's hottest club is Sam Ehrlich right
yeah,
now.
Yeah. Lays out that most of this legislation would have the same problem, because what it is doing is it's creating a federal law, it's creating federal standards, and then it's giving them to the NCAA and say, and you go run it, and you go figure out how it works. And the problem with that is that a court like the Fifth Circuit could look at this and say, no, that's Congress delegating its rulemaking and its enforcement authority, and it needs to have more oversight than that. That is a fixable problem, I should say. Like, this doesn't mean like these bills can't work. It might mean they have to change. But the changes would mean that Congress or some created governmental entity, maybe it's the Department of Education, who knows, would it be more actively involved in this? Would be it, like, I think the NCAA thinks like, well, we'll just get to go back to being king of the hill, cock of the walk. And in reality, the non-delegation doctrine means that, well, no, there will be someone above you who athletes can go complain to, who coaches can go say like, hey, I don't think the NCAA is doing its job the right way. And that will be somebody who's part of government. And I bring Matt's story and horse racing up because, look, this is something that is maybe going to go to the Supreme Court on the horse racing issue because it involves a circuit split. And that's a whole, like, now I'm really boring you. I'm not trying to do that.
Oh, yeah. This is just a picture of me paying attention.
But like, if you think we're going to pass this legislation and we'll never hear about it in court anymore.
Right.
And we'll never have to, I don't have to learn what standing is. And I don't have to worry about venue. And I don't have to think about how a bill becomes a law. I can throw all that out. I can get back to watching the TV I want to watch and having the good time I want to have. I just don't think that's very realistic. I think the path that the NCAA is screaming for is one where they will be back in the congressional doctor's office on a regular basis. They will be back in federal court on a regular basis. It may be a more pleasant one. It may be a basis that's more favorable to them than it is to athletes. But I don't think this creates a world where you're like, all right, great, problem solved.
Oftentimes on Phantom Island, on our other show, not this one, I use that format with Ryan to get really in down to the into the weeds of a subject and kind of stress test the take that we bring on to a big program like this. Thank you for listening. It's funny because the deeper we go, the more entrenched I get in the position that we are seeing this kind of throwing our hands up and begging the government for intervention, not because the equation on the board is impossible to solve, but because of what I'm seeing this morning, what I'm seeing from Ross Dellinger's reporting this morning, that the NCAA is now, if anything, running directly backwards. If the indications from where they are positioning their markup suggestions on Save College Act, see, it is terrible. You really stumble over it every time you say it.
Protect College Sports Act. I think it's Protect College Sports. I don't even think you have it.
It doesn't matter. It's going to die anyway. Ross said it had a sub 30% chance on Tuesday's show. But my frustration here, it's not about a political side or a personal belief anymore. It's that the NCAA is now running in the opposite direction. They are trying to achieve a pre-2019 status for control of players and their individual rights.
Yeah.
Based off of the suggestions this morning in the markups that they're trying to push through. It also seems, and we've asked Ross this, and we've asked people in politics this, we've asked people in the industry, that if they continue to push this and are successful in any way, more on the Cruz side, the Republican side is the one that is championing those who are, they want reason to come back to college sports, which really means we don't like that we're paying players. We don't like that they have free agency. Now, there's a rational middle to that saying we should work out some sort of rule set on transfers. It shouldn't be as ridiculous as it is. And I think everybody agrees in the middle. But if they're pushing this hard on this side of saying like, hey, we want to go back to the way it was, that can't happen. Mm-hmm. Plaintiff's attorneys like Darren Heitner, who's on social media this morning as we record this, saying, hey, we're going to go to court. We're going to do all this over again. Okay? If you walk back what the Supreme Court decided unanimously in a way that I'm still struggling in terms of, like, again, as a layman, to understand, Alston was a 9-0 decision.
Yeah.
If for some way, shape or form, the effect of Alston is nullified by this act that goes through the Senate and then is ultimately signed by the current president, we're just going to repeat this cycle all over again. It's not actually going to fix anything. So the big warning sign is that if government gets involved once, what we're learning from Matt's article, from what you and I have talked about previously, from Tommy Tuberville, a former college football head coach.
We're learning this from the Sports Broadcasting Act. Like, we talked about it before, but like the window into which the government can sort of get into the NFL's business, a thing that there is no federal legislation that creates the NFL and gives it rulemaking power and all of this. But even just through the window of the Sports Broadcasting Act, that's how the NFL can find itself in legislative hell.
Yes.
This is much broader than that and much more involved than that. And here's I haven't done the math, so maybe I'm extending this too far. We think of college football conference expansion and conference realignment in terms of which teams did you add. But I can pretty easily get you into a political map of Senate and House seats. And now I can say, oh, look at that. Now the Big Ten has a vested interest in California, which is not a small state. Now the SEC has a vested interest in Texas, which is not a small state.
Right.
And you can kind of see how it's like these conferences have now put themselves in a position where, well, we have political constituencies that we didn't have before. They're not small. They're not quiet. And I think it is more likely that we are just changing the form and the topic and the venue of these disagreements rather than creating long-lasting peace.
What a shock. Ryan, if you want to talk about something that's long-lasting, that never changes, that's a certainty in our sport, it's that your stadium, actually yours specifically, we're going to talk about next, mm-hmm. it needs renovation. We took a pause. We stopped for a little while because we had to pay those pesky players. But one thing's for certain, your stadium, it's not nice enough. When we come back, we're going to talk about a stadium that is so not nice, it needs over $1 billion of renovation not to add a single seat. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the College Football Inquirer. I'm Stephen Godfrey. That's Ryan Naney. We're subbing for two-thirds of the podcast, and it's the two-thirds that does the work and is intelligent and sourced. This is the one-third that hollers, who brought on his friend with a law degree. I excel at surrounding myself with people who have better academic and professional backgrounds so I can do really good homework on the bus before the report is due. Ryan Naney, as I was not joking in the previous segment, I am legally bound to constantly create college sports content only if one graduate of the University of Florida is president. Present. Sorry, not president.
Ah. Not president.
Oh, God.
Oh, boy. Spoke, we might live in that world one day.
I just spoke Marco Rubio into existence. I'm sorry. We're not. I want to talk about, because it is the dead of summer. I know everybody's like, please, please, more political coverage. Please, more infinitesimal descriptions of stuff that happens in the legal world. Please, 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 please. There's a little bit of news with your alma mater. You are a Florida graduate, correct?
Mm-hmm, correct?
Okay. I also want to do this because there's this great movie called Mid-90s, and it's where you don't have to worry about the plot of it, but there's a scene where the big brother's out, and that's Andy Staples for me. He's always been like my older brother in college sports media. And I'm basically running into his room on this segment because we should do this when Andy's here. Andy lives in Gainesville. Andy graduated from Florida. Andy is basically America's most knowledgeable Florida Gator person, and we're going
to— Andy has been to the swamp more recently than either of us.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, we were talking about this in show prep, and I was like, I don't know if I've covered a game in the swamp, and like, it's over 10 years, it might be closer to 15, and you as an alumnus, you haven't been in a while either, have you?
Yes, that's correct.
It's called having kids, folks. Don't do it. Florida is swinging the pendulum of stadium renovation way back, okay? I want to talk about my alma mater for a second, which is something I also have to do legally on every episode. I want to give you an idea because we're talking about the Southeastern Conference, the premier of college football and all that stuff, at least until we could start paying athletes, and then Indiana won a national title. Ole Miss was slated to dump a ton of money into renovation of Vaught-Hemingway Stadium. I can tell you as an alumnus, it kind of needs it. Ryan, you actually visited Vaught-Hemingway with me last year.
Yeah.
Vaught-Hemingway is unique because it's four distinct pieces that are put together. You could say a lot about weird college football stadiums, but that's pretty unique. I don't get that feeling about Ben Hill Griffin Stadium, affectionately known as the Swamp, but a $1.45 billion renovation is slated to begin of Ben Hill Griffin Stadium, Ryan. Billion dollars. Now there's a
couple.
Go ahead.
Can I add one more word to that?
Yeah.
That's estimated. This is going to be a long project, and I think we should not assume.
What are you implying, Florida man with a law degree?
I'll be optimistic. Maybe it'll only be $1.35 billion.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll find cost savings.
Because that's how construction works. They come in under budget and early.
You know that front section of IKEA where you can buy returned furniture at a much... Maybe there's that for stadiums. I don't know. Who's to say?
Oh, God. $1.45 billion. Now, I know what you're thinking if you are of maybe the elder millennial Gen X generation. Oh, God. How big is Ben Hill Griffin Stadium going to become? The answer is it's not. It is going to stay essentially at same size.
It's going to say the same capacity.
Yes.
I think there is a wrinkle in that we should interrogate a little bit. Currently, Swamp holds about 88,000 people. That's not an exact number. Florida has said that's going to be the number when renovations are done. So what's happening? Well, a couple of things. But for purposes of this argument, one thing that's happening is that they're adding a lot of suites. I want to say it's like 60 or 80 suites, something like that. They're renovating a lot of the existing ones, but to one side of the stadium, the east side that doesn't currently have any, I believe, they're adding a bunch of suites there. All right. Mm-hmm. So we're adding those. let's say it's 50 suites, and let's say a suite holds conservatively 20 people. Probably holds more than that, but let's say it's 20. Okay. That's
a I'm not nice, the fire marshal.
That's a nice tidy 1,000 people. Well, if we have those and the number's staying the same, that means we lost 1,000 seats somewhere else. And I'll tell you where it wasn't, in the other suites. So there, while the capacity may stay the same, the makeup and character of the capacity is definitely changing. Maybe it's not to some significant, like, noticeable degree.
Yeah.
But it is going to change in terms of, like, who's sitting where and how much money they had to get in there in the first place.
Lots of interesting things to talk about. I know you're thinking, well, I don't care about Florida and I don't care about stadium capacity, but the bleed over here is very interesting because, one, we saw basically a pause on dumping money into facilities at the advent of paying players. That's NIL and rev share. I'm just going to kind of lump all that in together. So 2019, the world changes in college sports. By 2021, you really don't see a lot of stadium projects going on. Now, there are a couple major exceptions that because the wheels got turning earlier than you know, people realized with what was going to happen with Alston. You know, universities often work on a really long, slow timeline, especially for major projects like this. So one thinks of Northwestern, who was displaced for a long time because they blew up. It's Ryan Field, right? Yeah, they blew up Ryan Field at Northwestern. Northwestern was homeless. They played in Wrigley. They bounced around. They are set to open their new sort of smaller capacity stadium, you know, on the water up there in Evanston. You can think of Kansas as well, who I think bounced around. I believe they played in the MLS stadium in Kansas City a little bit. They did the same thing where they basically said, hey, we got to shut down completely and we got to renovate and then we're going to move around. There's a couple others down in the group of Sam Houston did this to with less attention, I believe, last year. I don't know if they're back in their stadium this year. But the reason why I bring all this up is Florida's not doing this. Oh, by the way, the other one we should mention is the cocktail party, which is it's not allowed to be called that anymore, between Florida and Georgia. How excited are you for the cocktail party to be played inside of Mercedes-Benz Stadium in downtown Atlanta this year, Ryan?
And Raymond James Stadium the year? Oh, man.
Wow. So, feel the tradition.
So awesome.
Hope the Falcons doesn't get on you.
The other program we should mention there is Penn State,
which
is also doing a major renovation, not one that is maybe going to feel a little bit more like Florida. I think it's half the cost for one thing, but it is more geared towards, hey, we got to get more premium seating. We got to get more opportunities for sponsors to get on board. Whatever.
And Ryan, what is Penn State doing that Florida is doing as well? They are not vacating the premises.
Correct. Yes.
Which I also think, and based on what we've looked into, is one of the reasons why the price tag is so high. It would be easier to leave and tear the thing down to the studs. Also, I can just raise my hand as an American homeowner who's renovated rather than built. I'm a dummy. It's a dumb thing to do. Don't be a dummy, homeowner. Don't. I don't care if your significant other thinks like, oh, that's a charming arch, or I love those eaves. Yeah. Knock it down.
Yeah. Northwestern is obviously in Chicago. So they had, this is where it may be shocking for listeners to learn, Gainesville and Chicago are very different. The idea of Florida leaving creates the necessary question of where would they go? Where is the 88,000 plus capacity venue, or where is even the 60,000 capacity venue that they would go to? The closest geographically is probably in Orlando. It has a tenant already named UCF. And UCF and UF are not like best friends, I wouldn't say.
Forever.
Like the idea that, well, we'll just play these games in Tampa. Well, problem there too. Raymond James is already booked up and has a tenant, at least for the time being, a college football tenant in USF. And if you even if you tried to work around that, you're not going like we already mentioned Jacksonville's not available for a couple of years because they're renovating. It does sort of create a like there were not necessarily good options on the table. Oh, what if you want to? Nope. Miami, that one's booked up too. Like it does seem like this was the only way to do it. Unless you were going to get very, very creative in ways that fans probably would have completely hated.
I like to try and explore trends and try and find an emerging trend. If we are swinging back towards stadium construction, stadium renovation, and focusing, putting dollars on that, I find that interesting on a number of ways we can explore in future programs, because that tells me, all right, well, maybe people believe there is a roadmap for a more balanced individual athletic budget or university budget, or paying players is not going to be all consuming, or we're going to find something else. We're going to find a balance here, because Florida believes this is necessary. It also tells me another thing. Regardless of what you want to call it, college sports is professional sports. Okay, so AECOM Hunt designed this stadium, and Turner Construction, Ryan, you and I both live in Nashville, Tennessee. Turner Construction.
See them all over the place.
You see them all over the place right now because they are working on the $2.1 billion Tennessee Titans stadium that's going to host the Super Bowl in 2030.
Yeah.
Same firms, same people, same intent, which is a professional sports experience. Now, there are a lot of reasons why more luxury suites are going in. By the way, Missouri did this right when they joined the Southeastern Conference. Mm-hmm. They didn't really change their overall capacity, but they upped the amount of premium that they could offer. I personally have talked about this on the show. I was blown away going to Sanford Stadium in Athens, the work that they've done on that. And it had been like a 9-year gap, and I was there last year for the Texas game. The professionalization of the game day experience in college sports is yet another giant neon sign saying this is pro sports. It's just at a different mm-hmm. level, not even in terms of quality. People are, you know, stingy with their time. We all have big, really fancy 4K TVs at home now that are sold for really cheap from China. And it's getting harder and harder to create the urgency to fill a stadium. I also think that now, for sure, unless you want to push back on this, the idea of teaming capacity and building stacks and stacks of upper decks, we're done with that. I think maybe permanently we're done with the idea of like, well, our stadium has 150,000 seats.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's why Florida is trying to thread this needle, because this renovation has been talked about for years now. And the biggest fear Florida fans had was that capacity was going to go down. So the idea that Florida is out here immediately saying it's 88 today, it's going to be 88 when we're done, like that is targeted towards that fan base to sort of like soothe them and say, yep, we're not talking about moving down to a 60,000 seat stadium. It's very important to Florida that it maintain this atmosphere of like, this is a scary and loud and hot place to play.
Ryan, one more thing. If it's 88,000 seats today, and it's going to be 88,000 seats at the end of a $1.4 billion renovation, what does that tell me about the price of the ticket for one of those 88,000 seats?
I'm so glad you asked. Scott Strickland has talked about this, and I'll just quote him directly. I would say that the person is paying market rate today, and they're going to be paying market rate tomorrow. Now, that doesn't mean it won't be more. But we have an incredible demand for the product of coming and watching the Gators in the Swamp. I want to shout out Grandstand Magazine, which is part of the UF Journalism College.
Okay.
They ran a piece in April. Student season tickets for football at Florida have jumped from $140 in 2022 to $350 this upcoming season. On a per game basis in the SEC, only A&M is more expensive. These tickets are now twice as expensive as Michigan or Oregon season tickets. There's a lot that goes into like how you sell these and how they're like divvied up with other events or whatever. But that's what's happened to these tickets in anticipation.
This is before they've started actually paying for the renovation. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Combine that with the fact that I think it's inevitable that the quote unquote cheap seats, we're going to lose some of them in the process of adding these seats, these luxury items. The way Florida is talking about this, I think, is very smartly trying to tread a line. But they are sending signals that the goal here is let's get more sponsorship. Let's get more premium seating. Let's make this more of a concert venue. I don't think it's going to completely not feel like the old Swamp, but it is going to be for some different purposes.
Ryan Nanny, you have a legal degree. You have a Juris Doctorate. I have a PhD in discerning BS. What Scott Strickland is saying is the price of the brick is going up. Ryan Nanny,
100%.
Where can everyone find you and what can they listen to?
You can listen to Phantom Island. You can find it wherever podcasts are sold or available. You can go to phantomisland.show if you want to sign up and subscribe and listen to all of our episodes, including a special membership tier where you get to ask Stephen Godfrey questions. And he kind of sort of has to answer them. Not all of the time, but sort of like I poke him in the side and I say, hey, answer these questions, dummy.
As always, we have a mini series called Who Killed College Football, which if you noticed, it's not dead. So what happened there? WKCFB.com. Thank you very much. And the real hosts will be back on the next episode.